from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about a tool that empowers Milwaukee renters. Then we'll learn how Milwaukee's Silent Book Club provides readers a chance to get together.
This takes that pressure away and allows people the freedom to come and read the whole time and nobody's going to bat an eye at you. You can come and read for 5 minutes and then be like, I'm not feeling it today. I just want to hang out and talk. And people will absolutely dive into that too.
Plus, our astronomy contributor joins us to reflect on 2024 events at the Manfred Olson Planetarium, including the solar eclipse.
We had never had anything so big, and we were so lucky because the weather was gorgeous, and it just had a feeling of such camaraderie. The whole campus came together in a way that was really heartwarming.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee has some unfortunate statistics when it comes to landlords in the city. There are thousands of properties owned by out-of-state landlords, and about half of the city's rental properties are owned by a very small number of landlords, and in most cases, that drives up rent costs. So, if you're a current renter or looking for a new rental property, it's more important than ever to do your research before deciding on a property, and there's a tool for that. LandlordMapper.org has created a database of Milwaukee landlords and the properties that they maintain. John Johnson is one of the creators of the tool, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
How does the Landlord Mapper work? Walk us through the process of searching a property.
Yeah, so you can go to our website and put in the address of any rental property in the city of Milwaukee, just the city limits. And it'll tell you some information about that property, how much it's worth. It'll also tell you the other properties owned by that landlord and the other companies that are connected to that landlord. So large landlords, even some small landlords, often use a different LLC to own their different properties, sometimes one property per LLC. And so if you're just sort of naively looking at the data, it's very difficult to tell what a given landlord actually owns and the way that they behave across those properties. And so our tool does a network analysis of the names and addresses that are within these, what we call landlord networks, combines all of those together and gives you statistics for them. We calculate the eviction filing rate that those landlord networks have, the code violation rate, and the total value of the properties they held.
Sure. Now, how do you get this kind of information? Because as you say, each property might have its own LLC. A lot of this kind of data can be pretty opaque when you're just looking through it.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of programming that happens on the back end. It updates every weekday. It pulls the latest property records from the city assessor's office. So that's our source of truth for who owns properties. That gets updated perhaps a month after a sale takes place. Varies based on the time of year, but they keep it pretty updated. And then we've built an open source code workflow that you can go and look at on GitHub if you're a nerd who's curious about this stuff. And then every 3 months or so, we go in and add new eviction data and code violation data.
Mm. What would you say you've learned so far about Milwaukee landlords?
Two things. One is that if you think of the typical landlord, if you just have all the landlords and you randomly choose one of them, probably that landlord is very small. They might only own one rental property. There are many, many landlords in the city who only own one property or maybe two properties besides the house they live in. But if you were to pick a renter at random, probably that renter rents from a quite large landlord. There's a handful of really large landlord networks that own 40% of the properties in the city. The largest of them, Barada, uses over 100 LLCs, as best I can tell. So depending on the perspective you have, if you're thinking about the landlords that exist, you'll think, well, this is a market that has a lot of small actors in it. But if you're thinking about the experience that tenants are having, actually, there's a handful of landlords in the city who control an awful lot of the supply that exists there. And we see that landlords behave in very different ways, one company to another. Some of them file evictions constantly. and we see a lot of serial eviction filings. So they'll do it, you know, on the fifth day of the month if they haven't paid rent yet, just sort of as a matter of course, whereas other landlords will, you know, only file evictions when they really mean it. And we see that most of their eviction filings actually lead to an eviction order instead of just being a sort of routine part of the rent collection process. The amount of code violations varies a lot between landlords. Some of them keep their houses in better repair than others. And we suspect, though we don't have the data on this yet, that the sort of level of rents and the aggressiveness with which a landlord raises rents varies a lot between companies. But that's really difficult to get data on. We don't collect good data on rents in this country. And so I'm hoping to do more research on that in the future. This sort of work gives us the ability to understand how much consolidation is happening in the rental market, which before was kind of a mystery. You know, we know that Borata is a large landlord because you see lots of properties in town that have those boulders around them or have a sign that says Borata Properties out in front. But it's not like there's one company that actually legally owns all those properties. And so it took a project like this to really figure out how large is that group of companies.
Yeah, when you say consolidation, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, there's a landlord who has all of these different LLCs and that's kind of, you know, going under one umbrella? What does consolidation look like in this context?
Yeah, exactly that. So, you know, my research question is, what share of the rental apartments in the city are owned by, you know, let's say the largest five landlords or something like that? So we're working on a project now to try to understand, you know, is there pricing power in that market? Is there a level of consolidation that would kind of cause the competition that we expect to keep prices down in a market not to be happening? TBD, you know, we're still working on that project, but it's the kind of thing that we're able to do now that we're able to link landlords in this way. And then also the service we've made is designed to be a tool for tenants. You know, maybe you would prefer to have a large landlord because you think they'll offer prompter service, or maybe you'd prefer to have a small neighborhood landlord. This is a tool you can use to understand the size and complexity of the corporation you're renting from.
I think that really gets to the larger question of, you know, what are the ways that tenants or prospective tenants can use this tool and the information it provides? What can they do with that?
Yeah, I recommend anyone who's looking for apartments to use this tool to just understand more about who they might be renting from, because when you call the number you see on the listing, that, you know, that might just be a property management company. Or you might not really understand the relationship that person you're talking to on the phone has to the ownership of the house you're looking at. And this way you can see, you know, is this just a small landlord who only owns this property or only owns a couple properties? Or is this part of a corporate web of, you know, dozens of LLCs that all share a P.O. box in California? You know, you'll see examples of that sometimes. And while that in itself can't tell you, is this a good landlord or a bad landlord, you know, based on your past experiences, you might have preferences for a certain kind of landlord. And then also we do show eviction filing rates and code violation rates for those landlord networks. We redact the eviction information for individual properties that only have a few units, but when there's, you know, a larger number of units in a network, we'll tell you what that rate is, which might be useful information for some renters.
What do you hope to achieve as you're getting more information for this database? What are some of your goals for this tool personally?
Yeah, well, one goal is what we were just talking about, to let renters understand more about their landlords. As it is, when you apply to rent a unit, the landlord gets all kinds of information about you. You know, that background check is pretty extensive, but the renter might not even know who the landlord is. You know, they might not even know the name of the LLC they're renting from. They just know where they send the check. And so this is, I wouldn't say it evens the playing field, but it at least gives a little bit more information to a renter about what they're getting into. Then we have this set of research questions we want to answer to understand more about the market dynamics that are shaping the rental market in Milwaukee. And that has potentially some important policy consequences. I often have discussions with people who assume that a large corporate landlord would actually be better than small landlords, because in sort of an Econ 101 model, the thinking goes that a large landlord would be able to charge cheaper rents because they're spreading the risk over more properties. And so it's the risk is more manageable and they should be able to pass those savings on to renters, and that a large company would be more professional in the way that it responded to complaints and maintained properties than maybe a small part-time landlord would be. And, you know, there's a way in which, as a theory, that might make sense, but pretty much all the evidence that I've seen is the opposite, that actually small landlords tend to provide a higher quality tenant experience, to raise rents less aggressively, to file evictions at a lower rate, to only file evictions when they like actually intend to reclaim the property in breach of contract rather than as just part of the rent collection process, and various other things that other researchers have found, that a sort of neighborhood landlord tends to offer a higher quality experience. But it's only through rigorously answering those questions in an empirical way that I think we can say, okay, these are the kinds of landlords we want to encourage more of, and these are the kinds that we want to avoid in our city. And that matters for the kinds of building code updates or zoning code updates that the city might pursue. For example, there's a discussion in the city right now about making it easier to build accessory dwelling units, so like replacing your garage with a small housing unit. And most of those would be rentals. So it would be good to know, are sort of small-time landlords a good experience for tenants overall, in which case having a lot of these ADUs would be a good thing. In contrast, maybe we think that tenants could have the best experience renting from a large landlord in an apartment building, in which case, you know, there's things the city could do to promote that. So answering those kinds of questions about what creates the best tenant experience is a goal for this project.
All right. John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center and one of the creators of LandlordMapper.org. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last fall. The Port of Milwaukee has a whole ecosystem within the 467 acres that make up the port. It promotes shipping and commerce throughout the region and deals with domestic and international ships, plus rail and over-the-road transportation. Jackie Q. Carter is approaching 2 years on the job as the Municipal Port Director. A Milwaukee native, she's the first woman and the first person of color to serve in this position. She joins me to share what it means to be the Director of Port Milwaukee. Before we get into this, I'd like to know more about your background. You're a lifelong Milwaukeean, right?
I am. I was born and raised in Milwaukee, raised by my grandmother, grew up in 33rd and Walnut. So, and her house is still there. So we're still part of that neighborhood. Went to Milwaukee Public Schools, graduate of Marshall High School, and then went on to MATC, got an accounting degree there. Went from there to Alverno, pursued business and professional communication. And then my MBA is from Concordia College with an emphasis in public administration. And I kind of worked through school. So I was working for the city during the time that I was in school. And that's kind of how it happened. My original start in my career is in the nonprofit sector. And that had a lot to do with the programs that served me as a young person. So giving back to those programs and then eventually moving over into the public sector. So that's kind of how we got into the city. So
with your background throughout nonprofits and the city, someone on the outside who doesn't understand quite how the infrastructure of both the city and the port works might think that it's kind of a career out of left field for you to transition over to the port. Were you kind of surprised once you realized, like, oh, the port is an option and there's this whole other part of the city that not many people know about, but that's central to what we do?
Absolutely. You are spot on with that. And I was actually a little surprised. I never imagined that this would be where I would land. But I think it's important for people to understand that the port is really plays a real business liaison role for the city and for the region. So we help businesses to get their products to international markets. And then we also help to bring international products into this region. And so the port is kind of the facilitator of that through our tenants and our customers, making sure that they're, you know, they have what they need to be able to operate. So that means taking care of the infrastructure. That means, you know, making sure that the rail track that they need to move some of those commodities around is functional and up to date and can handle the cargoes that we're putting on them. That means the dock walls and the terminal buildings and different things that we own, making sure that stuff is up to par, but also working with the right folks. So bringing new business to the port where we can. We have a market development manager who's always out looking for new opportunities to connect with businesses and to help them understand what we offer. And so I think it is interesting that people don't necessarily always consider the port as part of the city, but the city, you know, being a steward of the residents and their tax dollars, the port is really an extension of that. And though we raise revenue and we're able to support a lot of the function that we do, we also contribute to the tax base by increase or raising enough revenue where not only do we cover our expenses, but there's money left over at the end of every year that we can then contribute back to the tax base, which helps to lower those rates and those bills that we receive.
So for people out there who are just learning about the role the port plays besides what we see going over the Hone, right, or on the edge of the cityscape, what does a port director do? What's your job?
So a port director makes sure that all the pieces are in place, basically. I mean, that's a really high level of it. But we are interacting not only with customers and tenants who are right here at the port, but also with our elected officials, the local elected officials, regional and national. So there's an advocacy piece. So we work with the American Great Lakes Ports Association and also the American Association of Ports Authorities. They both have an advocacy arm. And so we work with those groups to make sure that the needs of the region are understood by the people that represent us. So that's one part of it. The other part is making sure that the staff have what they need to be able to support all the things that go on at the port. So Port Milwaukee has four divisions. There's the marketing folks who go out and are working with the customers and the tenants to make sure that they have what they need and also making those connections. There's also the engineering folks who are making sure that that infrastructure is in place. So when those ships arrive, they can safely dock, that those commodities can be offloaded and all of the structures are in place, that the rail is working, that you know, the terminal buildings are safe and function in the way that our tenants, you know, need them to. Then we have operations, which really are kind of the boots on the ground folks who support the work. So those are crane operators, those are operations technicians. They're making sure that the roadways are clear. If there's debris out in the harbor, they're getting out on the port's work boats to clear some of that stuff up. You know, just supporting the needs of our tenants. And then we have finance, which is the part of the port that I originally came to. And that's making sure that the monetary resources are in place. We also are making sure the bills are paid and the people are paid, because the HR function also rests in finance. So those are like the four functional areas of the port and what we do.
Well, it just sounds like you got a lot to take care of.
Yeah.
Well, and as someone who's also grown up in Milwaukee, I think the most significant difference I've seen in the port in the past few years is cruise ships, commercial. It's no longer just barges that we grew up with. So that's one area of growth. What do you see as the most significant area of growth that the port has accomplished?
Yeah, I think you're right. Cruise ships is an area of growth. And I think that's one that really helps us to elevate our profile in the community, but also in the region, nationally. I mean, we've had some international coverage about cruise ships. So that's a really good one. And I think that's an area that I know we'll focus on, you know, continue to support what we've been able to build, but also building on it. So we have a cruise dock that we are gonna be building, because as you know, Viking, which is one of the larger ships that visits the Great Lakes, they're a lot bigger than the cruise ships we've seen in previous years. So we have the cruise dock that's right downtown adjacent to Discovery World, where they can house some of those smaller cruise ships. But with the ships that they're building now, they're a lot larger. And so that South Shore Cruise Dock is going to be a space where we're able to take some of those cruise ships and get them out of the commercial side of the port, because right now they're docking at our heavy lift dock, which is right in the middle of all the salt piles and different things like that. And so we want to get them out of there and put them over across right behind the Lake Express Ferry. So that's one big thing. But I think also, I guess, elevating our profile so that businesses understand. That's really where a lot of my work, I believe, is going to happen, is getting out into the business community, making sure they understand the services that we're offering, making sure they understand the tenant partners that are down here and, you know, what they're able to offer, and making those connections. So that's really where a lot of the work is going to come from, you know, in the future.
You're also the first person of color and the first woman in this role. What does it mean to you to make local history? And if this is the case for Milwaukee, I imagine the overall landscape of the port workforce in the U.S. and Midwest doesn't differ too much.
That is absolutely true. There are not a lot of people in this industry that look like me, but I do believe that we all end up where we're supposed to be, right? And I think the significance of that, especially with my background and life skills, you know, we spend a lot of time giving young people the message that they could be whatever they wanted to be. And so if someone who looks like me can walk into an industry that traditionally people like me don't work in, that's a story of hope, right? That's a story of being able to overcome. So being that example to young people in our community, you know, that anything really is possible. Because if you'd asked me 20 years ago, would I even work at the port? I would have had no idea. But I think you kind of go as the path leads you, right? And so the fact that I've been able to end up here, you know, as the port director, as the first woman, as the first person of color, I think my responsibility is making sure that I'm not the last, right? So connecting with young people in the community, making sure they know the things that we offer and what's possible for, as far as a career. There's a lot of different professions that operate in the port. And so making sure that, you know, there's community engagement where we're able to expose young people to all of those different options that exist right here in the community, that's really important.
Well, Jackie, congratulations on your latest appointment. I wish you the best of luck, and I look forward to all the changes to come.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jackie Q. Carter is the director of Port Milwaukee. She and I first spoke in 2023 when she was appointed. Her 2-year anniversary as port director is coming up next month. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll look back on the biggest events at the UWM Manfred Olson Planetarium from 2024. But first, we'll visit Milwaukee's Silent Book Club. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Silent book clubs are popping up all over the world, including right here in Milwaukee. But what exactly are they? WUWM's Excret Nunez and Mayan Silver stopped by a silent book club in Bayview to find out.
Walk into Component Brewing Company on a weeknight, and you'll hear the sounds of a typical bar. The bartender is slinging snifters filled with IPAs and lagers to people sitting around and talking on tall orange bar stools. Garage punk lilts in the background.
But look a little closer and you'll see a smattering of others silently reading, spaced around the room. Some have their eyes buried in ebooks, others are looking at paperbacks or hardcovers. Many of them are strangers, and they're each reading something different.
What am I reading? I'm reading Moby Dick.
I'm reading Parable of the Talents.
Tim Sense and Jacob Anderson are sitting at the same long wooden table. They're here for Silent Book Club, and they're trying to figure out whether they've met before.
Were you reading The Silmarillion last time?
Yeah.
All right, so yeah, we did. I thought so.
Yeah, we did meet the first time I came. We met, yeah.
A Silent Book Club gives readers a chance to be social, but it unfolds a bit differently than in a traditional book club. First of all, you don't have to read the same book. Silent Book Club also happens in a public place instead of someone's home. Think coffee shop or bar. The first hour usually involves some on-scene solo reading of a book of your choosing. The second part of the night is when you vibe with other readers. Here's book club goer Tim Sense.
Well, we generally, and this isn't really structured, it's just kind of how it happens, we generally sort of just ask each other, what are you reading? And we present a book, and generally people kind of chime in if they've heard of it or if they've read it.
The whole meeting usually lasts about 2 hours and takes place once a month, usually on Tuesdays at various locations. And you can join in on any or all of it, says Meredith Klusman, the curator of Milwaukee's Silent Book Club chapter.
This takes that pressure away and allows people the freedom to come and read the whole time, and nobody's going to bat an eye at you. You can come and read for 5 minutes and then be like, I'm not feeling it today. I just want to hang out and talk. And people will absolutely dive into that too. Because the core, for me at least, is to create those connections, especially as a transplant to Milwaukee. That's really what drove me to want to do it in the first place.
Klusman's Milwaukee chapter isn't alone. Silent book clubs are popping up everywhere. According to the Silent Book Club website, there are over 1,400 chapters in 54 countries. Klusman says she got the idea from TikTok and started Milwaukee's first chapter in the summer of 2023. I asked her about how popular it's become.
I saw the Facebook page. Almost 900 people.
I don't promote it at all. I made the page and I like sent it to my 5 cousins that live in Milwaukee and was like, all right. And I'm assuming that other people saw the social media posts that I saw on TikTok or whatever and were like, hey, let's check it out.
Anderson, one of the readers who showed up tonight, says he appreciates turning reading from something you do by yourself to something social.
People who are willing to go and read a book in public silently are usually like-minded people, so.
He also says he just likes to experience new things.
Sometimes days can blend together. They don't when I do a silent book club day.
As the first hour of reading winds down, more people join Anderson, Sense, and Klusman at the table to discuss their books. One person is reading Sherlock Holmes, which sparks some conversation.
Like a symbolized language and figure out.
Wow. Like the answer to the mystery is actually in the reading.
If you can decode. That's what I remember. I know, maybe.
Klusman, the organizer, says the community aspect of the club is important to her, especially during the times we're living in.
I feel like the world can be a very divisive place, especially within the last couple of years. I feel like as much as we try to move with empathy and embrace uniqueness and diversity, that's very clearly not the MO of everybody in the world. So it's really important to me to foster an environment that's inclusive of everyone.
Thankfully, to no one's surprise, readers make wonderful customers. Component Brewing bartender Casey Sams is all for normalizing reading at a bar, or in any public place, really. And he has something to say to anyone who thinks it may be weird to do so.
First of all, book readers are not weirdos. Let's make sure we let everyone know that. But yes, I agree with having the community part, because how I might interpret what I'm reading could be totally different than what you're interpreting. You know, you get some good conversations and maybe you learn something new.
As the vibe at Component Brewing Company shifts from punk rock silent reading to its themed trivia night, Klusman starts thinking about the next silent book club meeting. She says anyone is welcome to come turn the page with them or with the second chapter of the club that recently opened up in the Milwaukee area. It's a moment to drink, read, and be social.
That was WUWM's X Grit Nunez and Mayan Silver visiting a silent book club meeting in Bayview last November. You can learn more about Milwaukee's Silent Book Club chapter at WUWM.com. As we're in the first month of 2025, it's tempting to look ahead at what goals we want to work toward in the new year. But it's also important to acknowledge what happened this past year and celebrate those moments too. For astronomy contributor Gene Creighton, 2024 was one of the most exciting years for the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee in its nearly 60-year history. From planning for over 2 years for the solar eclipse and welcoming 20,000 people on campus to student-led planetarium shows and hosting MPS third graders, the planetarium and its staff have a lot to celebrate. Jean Creighton joins me now to look back on some of the most notable moments of 2024 for her and her team. Jean, welcome back to Lake Effect. Happy New Year.
Happy, happy New Year to you, Audrey. Lovely to be with you.
So you have an upcoming open house for the planetarium. And before we get too focused into everything that's coming in the new year, I want to take a moment to take a look back at all the amazing things you and the planetarium and the whole staff accomplished in 2024. And obviously one major event that brought so many people to campus was the solar eclipse. And yes. In your history of being the director, had you had an event of this scale ever before like that?
No, we had never had anything so big. And we were so lucky because the weather was gorgeous. And it just had a feeling of such camaraderie. The whole campus came together in a way that was really heartwarming. We had over 4,000 people. And I've had several people since say, you know, this was the best thing they've ever done on campus.
Oh,
and I thought, yes.
Perfect. Well, and not just students, obviously, but like people in the community, school groups. And
everybody. Yeah, everybody. Yeah, I mean, people, everyone. Neighbors, obviously campus people, but also some schools came, just brought their classes because they were worried that they wanted to be able to be safe. And they knew that they'd get glasses on campus. Mm-hmm. We ran out eventually. I mean, we had ordered 10,000 pair and we had been giving them out in the community over time so that if people wanted to travel to see the total eclipse, they could. But at the end, when we were running out, we said, share, find a buddy and you know, share. So one of the people after emailed me and said that she enjoyed the event better because she was sharing with others.
And having a true communal collective experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So well, that was unforgettable.
Yeah. And you did have to have some contingency plans because you don't know what the weather's going to be like. So it wasn't just, hey, let's prepare for a solar eclipse and assume the day is going to be bright and sunny, right?
No. We had a little preview, a sneak preview, because we had a partial eclipse in October that was an annular eclipse and the weather was completely nasty. And this was a gift because it reminded us, oh, right, this isn't, oh, let's now make a plan 24 hours before. Let's assume that this is going to be an indoor-outdoor event, and if it's beautiful and clear, great. And if not, we had various activities indoors. We had a NASA feed in places where the solar eclipse was total. So it was really fun. It was really fun.
But a lot of work.
2 years. We planned for that for 2 years.
Well, 2 years and over 21,000 people came to enjoy that. So congratulations on that feat. And on the note of people coming and, you know, experiencing the space, perhaps for the first time, you also hosted third graders throughout MPS. So not just a handful of schools. You did all third graders, right?
Yes. So that was basically double the normal schools that we get. Normally we have about 100 a year. And this year we had more than 200, which means that I can't do 200 school groups in addition to everything else. So a couple of my staff did a great job in doing some of the presentations too. So it's always fun to think that you're putting a little seed in some kid's mind that maybe they could become, you know, an astronomer or a scientist, but even if they don't, they can always enjoy, you know, the sky. So I think it's a real gift that we have, that we get to put that spark in people's mind.
Absolutely. And speaking of staff that helped you throughout not just grade school presentations and the eclipse, they also put on a show by themselves, one that we talked about last year called The Creepy Cosmos, was student-led. So can you share what that was like for you as a director to feel the confidence or at least the care to be like, all right, I'm going to stand back and this one's yours?
You know, to me, it's a sign that I'm growing up too, right? That I have now worked enough with undergraduate students and we've developed enough of rapport and respect that I know what they can do. So I can say, you know what? They've got this one. And maybe it would liberate them if they were completely free to do whatever. And I enjoyed, I mean, I did attend some of the rehearsals just to give them some suggestions, some guidelines, but their instincts were excellent. And I thought the show, it was sold out. It was so much fun that we're going to do it again.
Oh, perfect.
Both of the people who are performing are graduating. This will be their last sort of Halloween season. So it seemed appropriate that they get another crack at it.
I say that's a good parting gift for sure. Speaking of shows and series, obviously there's so many throughout the year that you do at the planetarium, but one series in particular I want to highlight was the Shared Sky series. Can you explain what that was for people who maybe didn't get the chance to see it?
Sure. So for many years now, I've come to understand the value of connecting astronomy with daily life, with culture. And we've had kind of, a variety of programs about this and that, different cultures, different parts of the world. And eventually it occurred to us, why not have a kind of an umbrella so that if we do, let's say, 8 or 10 of these a year, that they kind of are part of a recognizable brand, if you will. So we call them our Share Sky. And it gives us an opportunity to say, talk to an African astronomer. We flew, in fact, this year, Susan Murabana from Kenya, who talked about her work, her outreach work, and programs. We had a person, Puchen, came and talked about how Lunar New Year is celebrated in parts of China. So that's the kind of thing that makes you appreciate other places, how people do things, how they connect to the celestial. I think it's fascinating and it makes the world kind of closer,
Absolutely. And, speaking of making things closer, opening up a space for people to come and commune, what do you hope people will experience or what are you welcoming for this open house for people to come and visit you?
Well, I'm hoping that people who haven't come before to the planetarium and are curious will come and see the programs that we're going to be offering. So they kind of think, ooh, I want to put Scale of the Universe on my calendar right now, for example. And also to look at stars. Winter is a mixed blessing because it is cold, but the nights are long, it gets dark early, and the sky can be crystal clear with beautiful bright stars. The nice thing about the planetarium is that it's at room temperature. No chance of
Yes.
precipitation. And in fact, the stars are beautiful, almost as beautiful as they are in a very dark sky and more comfortable for sure. So I'm hoping that they'll come and find more out about our programs, take our little, we designed little booklets that you can take with all our programs for the semester and see the space and say, wow, we want to come back again.
Well, in reviewing all, just a fraction of everything you did in 2024, I'm wondering what's the first word that comes to your mind when you reflect on this past year?
I really would say outstanding. It's just stands out from the rest of the years. And the eclipse, of course, was big, but this was also the year where we were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first planetarium, and that's wrapping up in May of 2025. So the celebration of the 100th anniversary started in October with Mae Jemison's visit, the first African American woman in space. And it's going to wrap up with the Starball party, which we're having in March. And we're going to keep going with this wonderful momentum.
Absolutely. Well, Jean, thank you so much for joining me. And until our next conversation, where we highlight something new happening.
I always look forward to it.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. The planetarium is hosting a free open house this Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. to celebrate its 59th birthday. There's more information as well as our past conversations at wuwm.com. We'll take one more break and then we'll learn how real events in 1921 Milwaukee inspired a novel for young readers. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You may recall all of the excitement there was when some thought there was a Milwaukee lion roaming around back in 2015. While it was never found, this event inspired one local author to look into other animal escapes that actually did happen here. How to Catch a Polar Bear by Stacy DeKaiser is a novel set in 1948 Milwaukee, when there was still a zoo at Washington Park. To share more about the book and the true events that inspired it, I'm joined by author Stacy DeKaiser.
In April of 1921, a full-grown male polar bear named Clown escaped from the Washington Park Zoo overnight and roamed the neighborhoods around Washington Park for a few hours before he was caught. It happened to be early morning, so not too many people were out, but the newspaper reports did mention something about spilled trash cans and possibly a startled milkman before the police caught up with Clown.
So how do you learn about Clown and, you know, his escape?
That's a good question. I was trying to remember that as I was preparing for our talk today, and I don't really remember how and when I found out about Clown. It might have been there was an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel a few years back when there was the Milwaukee lion story going out, that people thought there was a lion on the loose somewhere in town, but nobody could, like, find him. And I think that inspired an article in the Journal Sentinel that brought up
other animal mishaps.
Yes. And I think that might have been what it was. And it was probably, if I had to guess, I would say it was like 2018 or 2019, because I started writing this book in March of 2020, which happened to be the day or the month I, like, started not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I read about it first.
Yeah. So that prompted this book. Can you share a bit about what How to Catch a Polar Bear is about? And this is a book for young readers.
It is. Yeah. Readers 8 and up. It's about three 12-year-old friends who live in Milwaukee in 1948, about three blocks from the city zoo. So the zoo is their playground. And they decide they need to solve the mystery of how a polar bear escaped from the zoo.
One of the central characters to this story is 12-year-old Nick, who is also in your book before this. But what helps you to not just think about what Nick would do in this new story and adventure scenario, but also how to write it to appeal to the preteen reader?
That was a bit of a challenge, at least it was at first, because I've never been a 12-year-old boy, so it's kind of hard to, and it's written in Nick's voice. He's the narrator of both How to Catch a Polar Bear and The Rhino in Right Field, which is the previous book. It took me a long time because when I first started writing, it was in third person, and it was felt very stiff and stilted and just slow. And so I knew I needed to switch to first person, and it took me a while. It took me, like, draft after draft after draft of a bunch of chapters before I finally found Nick's voice. And it got to be fun after a while to just sort of look at the world through the eyes of a 12-year-old and remember what's important to them and what's not. So I was just trying to think of things from the point of view of a 12-year-old helped. And my husband tells me I'm kind of stuck in pre-adolescent emotionally. I'm not sure if that's true, but I think I've been lucky that I've sort of been able to remember being 12, even though I wasn't a boy.
When it comes to revisiting Nick, why do you want to do that versus potentially write a new character for this story? How did you want him to grow, or did you want to just kind of get back in that mindset with him?
A little bit of both, I think. The character Nick is based on my dad's childhood. My dad is also named Nick. And so I really have enjoyed writing that character and sort of just immersing myself in the world of 1948 Milwaukee, and because it's allowed me to do a lot of research and just learn about the history of my hometown. So that was one big draw. And I think there's just so many stories to explore regarding the Washington Park Zoo era and area and the culture and society at that time, which is very different in a lot of ways from what it is now, but also has a lot of similarities. I think kids back then were very similar in a lot of ways to how they are now. And I like the idea of showing kids that they have this bond across the years.
You mentioned doing a lot of research into Milwaukee during this era, and you had some great local resources, one of them being the Milwaukee Public Library Archive. So I'm curious, what were some of your keyword searches that you did for the stories?
Well, Washington Park Zoo, for sure, was one. And then, polar bear escape or animal escape. monkey escape. It turns out that there were quite a few monkey escapes.
Yeah, I didn't know about that one.
I didn't either. It was quite a surprise. So yeah, those sorts of words. And yeah, they brought up some wonderful photos and also newspaper clippings. Yeah.
Yeah, and especially to read things as they're happening in real time in those archives, right?
Right, yeah. Even more than the articles themselves, the ads that were in the newspapers on that day or like the movie listings or the radio listings were really also very informative.
Yeah, I love looking at those. Yeah. Another resource you used to help write this story was the County Zoo, which also has a librarian, which a lot of people might not know or think about. So what did you learn from them that stood out to you, even if it didn't make it into the book?
Oh, wow. Yeah, the Milwaukee Zoo Library is one of my favorite places because, like, it has two awesome things in the same place. Yeah, to think that the zoo has a library, just I still love that whole concept. And Mary Kazmierczak is the zoo librarian, and she's been very helpful to me. She's still answering my emails. I still ask her questions, even though the book is finished, and she's very kindly answers them for me. But we had a really long discussion by email a while ago about the moat around Monkey Island, in the original Monkey Island at the Washington Park Zoo. And was there or was there not a boat in the moat? And we finally determined that there was a boat. And then the question is, like, was the boat tethered to the island or could the monkeys go anywhere? And if they could, like, maybe they could escape. So we went back and forth many times about the speculating, and she dug into the archives and she found out. So we did establish, yes, there was a boat, and she did determine, in fact, just a little while ago, that yes, it was tethered probably to the dock on the island, so the monkeys could not like paddle across the moat and jump out. I don't think the boat did make it into the book. It was could have been a really critical plot point because there is a monkey escape in the zoo, but I don't think I used that, but it was still really fun to research.
As you mentioned, your dad's childhood in Milwaukee inspired your book, both this one and the one before, The Rhino in Right Field. And another central character is the Washington Park Zoo. So can you share more about how you felt revisiting the Washington Park Zoo for this? Do you feel like you have a better picture of what it must have been like and can place yourself in that time and space?
I do so much in that. I think if I were to go up there right now, I would be surprised that the zoo is not there. I would really expect it to be there. And so I did walk around the park, the section of the park where the zoo used to be, to try and identify like vestiges of the original zoo. And there's not much left there, but there is some of the roadways are the same, and there are a couple retaining walls that are there. Other than that, and I think there's like a concrete pad where a snack bar used to be. There's not that much left anymore. And what really impressed me is that how small an area it is, just a few acres and just not much at all. It's hard to imagine like 400 different species of animals being crammed to this one tiny little spot.
Yeah. If we're going to go walking there, can we find, like, say, the retaining walls you mentioned?
Well, the zoo itself was on the southwest corner of the park, and so like where the senior center is and around that area, so the corner of Bleet Street and 47th Street. So if you park on Bleet Street just east of 47th, like sort of in front of the senior center, just to the east of the senior center, there's a little circular driveway and a parking lot, and there's a stone retaining wall with a like a 3-foot-tall chain link fence on top of it. And that retaining wall was the wall for the buffalo pen. And I think there was a moose there for a while too, but the buffalo were like right there. The retaining wall is what kept them from escaping. So that's literally
crazy.
Still there. Yeah.
Now that you've been in this world of Washington Park Zoo, even though it doesn't exist anymore, there's the Milwaukee County Zoo, but when people go to the zoo, say, having read your books, whether it's the kids or the parents who read them with their children, what do you want them to think about next time they're strolling through and looking at the animals?
Yeah, I think, maybe they should think how Nick thinks, too. What have the animals given up to give us a nice day in the summer? Because they did not ask to be there. But zoos are for people, and I think they serve a wonderful purpose. But I think it's nice to know that we're sort of recognizing our responsibility to animals now, and that we need to give them the best life we can while serving our own needs, and not just for entertainment, but for education and for preserving different species around the world. So I just hope that kids like learn to appreciate the animals they're looking at and realize that they're sentient creatures, that they're here for us, and maybe to, you know, tell them thanks for letting us share time with them.
Well, Stacy, thank you for your time today and for sharing more about how to catch a polar bear.
Thanks for having me, Audrey. It was fun.
Stacy DeKaiser is the author of How to Catch a Polar Bear and other books for young readers. We spoke in 2023. You can hear DeKaiser read an excerpt from her book at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, the executive director of a nonprofit that works to preserve land and water in the Lake Country region is leaving the organization. She shares her accomplishments with Tall Pines and what's next for the organization and their mission to protect natural areas in the state. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.